the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues. Today's host is the senior editor for Financial Sense, Chris Sheridan.
There are some out there who are advocating a completely different paradigm for how to view the economy and money and the role of money within the larger global economic system. One of those individuals is George Mobus. He is the associate professor at the University of Washington's Institute of Technology. He is also the co-author of Principles of Systems Science, a textbook that was released in 2014. And he specializes in a field called general systems science. George, thank you for coming on to the show today. I want to ask you about the way in which we can view money in terms of energy. And of course, this field of study called biophysical economics, and I know there's also ecological economics, and get into a lot of the interesting points and topics that you discuss very regularly. But before we do that, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about your background? Because I know you come from a computer science background, and you're now applying a lot of this towards how we view the economy and, once again, money.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for inviting me. It's a pretty eclectic background. I do have a PhD in computer science, and that's my day job here, teaching computer science and computer engineering, mostly to undergraduates, but a few graduate students. But before that, I actually was in business managing a company in Southern California near San Diego, and I got an MBA along the way just so I'd supposedly know what I was doing while I was managing this company. Prior to that, though, I was a biologist. I got my undergraduate degree from the University of Washington Seattle campus many years ago. That was in biology. And over the years, it has been an effort of mine, if you will, to try to combine all that stuff together, to actually look at what is common across all of those boundaries. And that led me to systems science, which is just that attempt to try to understand how all the different things that we tend to call systems have very similar properties and functions. And just to give you an example, I developed some computer algorithms for control systems, and specifically for a robot, that were based on trying to simulate real biological neurons in animals and something like a brain in an animal. And that worked out pretty well. The experiments that I did showed that the robot was actually able to learn using that algorithm. So it's been basically a career of trying to find those similarities and then apply them in practical situations.
It's very interesting because we just spoke to an expert at Stratfor, their technology and energy analyst, on neural networks and all the breakthroughs that we're seeing in AI research and development with neural networks, whether or not it's AlphaGo and robotics. So that's something that we just touched upon, interestingly enough. We shall save that for perhaps maybe later in the interview or for another interview. But let's talk about today about biophysical economics and how that differs from the dominant paradigm that we discussed today or that you see in academia, which is referred to as neoclassical economics. What's the difference between those two?
Fundamentally, biophysical economics started from the standpoint of the scientific approach to work, production of wealth, and the distribution of that wealth based on the flow of energy. If you think about it, and this is not sort of a common way of thinking about it, but literally everything that we do, so the whole economy, is ultimately based on work, physical work. And work, by definition, requires energy. So energy is sort of the fundamental backdrop against which all economic activity occurs. And you can model this. You can build models of economic phenomena based on that idea. Neoclassical economics started from a presumed model, that is, somebody literally invented a model, ironically trying to emulate the successes of physics, which had their theoretical models that they used to make predictions about the way the world works, and experimentalists go out and see if they're really true. In economics, we had this set of assumptions that were made primarily in the mid-19th century, and then people have elaborated on those models. Ultimately, however, they're based on the notion of a closed system. That is, you got the households on one side of the economy where consumption takes place and labor is supplied, and then you've got production, the firms on the other side of the economy where production takes place, products are made for consumption, and laborers are utilized for getting things done. So you've got these, you can think of it as two circles slightly spread apart with arrows going from one to the other and back and forth, and that's it. So the whole breakdown of that economic model into smaller units as we go from macro to micro phenomena is essentially based on the assumption that this is all a closed system. The problem with that is that it takes into no account whatsoever the fact that coming into that system from the outside, from the Earth's resources, are all these things of minerals and energy in the form of fossil fuels and so on and so forth, and that those are in fixed supply. Those do not grow over time. Similarly, on the output side, the products, the waste products of society have to go back out into the environment, and we now know that that's causing tremendous pollution problems. Those factors were never, ever considered in the neoclassical economic framework. And yet now those are becoming some of our most difficult and perhaps even intractable problems. So that gives you a sort of a basic breakdown. Biophysical economics works mostly with the front end, the resource supplies, particularly energy going into the economy. And ecological economics primarily looks at the effects of the output from the economy and the damage that it does to the environment. So that in a thumbnail sketch is it's basically the differences.
So the dominant paradigm that we see today, neoclassical economics, it received a lot of its inspiration from physics. I guess we could say it's largely reductionist. It's trying to take complexity and boil it down to something that is easy to understand. But it sounds like biophysical economics or the ecological economic framework is more of, like you said, an open system framework. It's more holistic. It incorporates a lot of the other variables that are excluded from the neoclassical model. And I think, like you said, pollution is a really good example, or the diminishment of resources over time.
Yeah, that's fundamentally right. Neoclassical, it was inspired by physics. It doesn't actually use anything from physics, but it was inspired by the fact that physicists had developed these theoretical models, which were fairly simple in form. They just involved some mathematics. So they got the inspiration that, gee, economics ought to have something like that. Hence the strong emphasis in the economic world on advanced mathematics. You need the advanced mathematics, higher math, in order to tackle some of the modeling that they do. But the biophysical is actually based on physics. It actually uses real physics, namely, you mentioned it, thermodynamics, to help explain what is going on.
So tell us a little bit more about how thermodynamics is incorporated into this biophysical view of the economy.
Okay, so just imagine if we took every firm and just called it a work process, because work gets done inside. Even if it's mental work, it's still people consume food, which is energy, and their brains produce heat as a result of that. But every single work process takes in energy in order to do work. It has to perform work on something, whether it's manufacturing, changing the configuration of matter so that it fits our needs better, whatever it might be. But that's real physical work. And energy comes into that work process in a what we call a high grade or high potential form, like electricity or very high temperature heat or something of that nature. And then in the process of doing the work, some of that energy actually gets dissipated as very low potential energy or waste heat. And that goes out into the environment, out into the atmosphere, and it's lost forever. So energy, as it proceeds through the economy, is actually being degraded all the time. Unlike material, which to some extent, hopefully more extent than we're doing right now, but to some extent, the material can go into the work process, get transformed, get consumed or used, and over a period of time, it kind of breaks down from its practical value and we throw it out. But in theory, anyway, that could be recycled. We could recover the material from that. For example, we try to recover as much of the rare earth substances that go into our electronics by taking the old thrown-out electronics apart and using various methods to recover that. But you can't recover the heat, the energy. It's gone forever in the sense of being able to do useful work. So those are some major factors. That's the way thermodynamics works. That's the so-called second law of thermodynamics. We have to pay attention to it. It's a factor in everything that we do. And if we don't pay attention to it, then we kind of run into the problem that we're running into right now, which is the supply of energy, which primarily from fossil fuels. As that becomes harder and harder to get, meaning it takes more energy to get the next unit of energy, then eventually we're going to run out and that's it. There's no more energy to use.
I want to ask you about how money operates in the system in this way of viewing the economy. And in one of your presentations, you write that money is a, quote, token in a message flow system used to convey information to control the flows of matter and energy. To me, that sounds like a really interesting way of viewing money. It seems a little bit similar to kind of the way that Friedrich Hayek, if you're familiar with his work, described the market and the price signals in terms of allowing economic actors to efficiently coordinate their actions in a very non-centralized manner. So tell us a little bit more about money in this process.
Okay, well, maybe I should start by going back a little bit and looking at what I would call the real currency of an economy. And the real currency is, in these terms, the energy, because that's what you need to supply and pass around in order to do the various kinds of work that get done in the economy, whether it's producing goods or services or what have you. So that's going to happen. You have to have the supply of energy in a high potential form in order to get anything done. Now, if you want to decide in a social sense, as society wants to decide what areas, what kinds of work really are more important, then you have to have some way of controlling the flow of energy and making sure that it goes to those work processes that we find produce products that are of higher value. So how do you do that? Well, way long ago in the Neolithic era, people just sort of knew. They had a very good sense of how much effort they had to put in to grow wheat or raise pigs or whatever the case might be. And they could fairly readily barter their efforts in the form of the products that they produced. And that was all well and good. But as society got more and more complex, we needed something that would facilitate the control of the flow of energy and still in a social context without there being necessarily a central controller that said, oh, we need more of this. We know how that turned out in the Soviet Union. This approach to allowing people to pay prices in a token form for the things that they found more valuable worked out pretty well. And, you know, money has gone through an evolutionary process, starting out with as basically just being marks on clay tablets to becoming tokens like coins that were given a certain nominal value. And then people could use that to decide what products they were going to buy. And that helped decide what products were going to get produced. But it all represented the flow of effort that was going to be put into various production capabilities. Somewhere along the line, the whole concept of money got greatly, greatly distorted, especially when people started borrowing. Fractional reserve banking is an example. When people started borrowing money and going out and doing stuff, that was great. That was investing in some production capacity that they thought was going to pay off. But in the meantime, that money coming out of the bank is no longer available to the people who put it in the bank, even though they believe it's still there. And somewhere along the line, our accounting system decided that we would just pretend that it really was there. So people still had credit for holding that money. Now, just a variety of things have taken place over time. We've gotten into so-called financial instruments of a wide variety that represent nominal monetary value, when in fact, it's mostly based on trust. There's nothing really backing it up. So once upon a time, the actual units of money did represent purchasing power. And that purchasing power was the way of directing the flow of energy to the work that needed to be done. Now, money is taken on a life of its own. People think of money as creating money. You invest money in the stock market, for example, and magically more money comes into being. So we've gotten away, our whole economic system has gotten away from understanding that what we really need to be doing is controlling the flow of energy, not just making stuff up out of smoke and mirrors, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. And I think this leads into my next question, and that's the energy standard for money. What is that, and what do you mean by an energy standard?
Well, it's not even clear to me now that we could ever impose such a thing. But what it means basically is this. We could actually create an accounting system very similar to the one that we have now. For example, the cost accounting system. Inside a firm, we want to keep track of all the dollars that we're spending in order to do our work. And so we have this cost accounting system, and we accumulate costs, and every once in a while we check to see whether or not the prices that we're able to charge for those products exceeds the cost, and thereby producing some profit for us. And it turns out that it really works the same way with energy. We can accumulate or aggregate all the energy inputs to production in real physical terms, like BTUs is probably the term most of your listeners are familiar with, British thermal units. But we could use those units of energy, and as work gets done, we can measure directly exactly how much energy is being used up in each one of those. Then, at the same time, we can look at what we're going to get for that, but therein lies the problem. We could add up all the energy units, but there's no way of knowing what that is because our customers don't just give us energy. We have to get that from energy sources. What the customers can do, though, is give us these tokens as they were originally devised, called money, and that money would then represent a certain amount of energy that we could turn around and use that to buy from our energy sources. So there is a tight connection between the original idea of what money was and how it worked and the flow of energy. So if we were to adopt an energy standard similar to the gold standard in intent, but quite different in terms of the reality of what it stood for. Because energy is a real thing that has real value, whereas gold was arbitrary thing that looked pretty and people desired for whatever reason. So that's what the energy standard for money would be. But as long as we're dealing with financial markets that create new money, not based on any actual work that's getting done, but based on a market that drives prices up when people think something is of value, but they don't know for sure, but everybody else is doing it, so I better do it too, that kind of thing. I don't know that we could actually go back and successfully create an energy standard for money. But it's an idea to at least, it's like a baseline or a benchmark, if you will, for what money could be.
You know, it seems like there are actually some applications in that direction. I'm not sure if you've heard of SolarCoin, but they are trying to equate money to megawatt hours of solar electricity that are being generated. And so you can claim solar coins, you can create solar coins if you create electricity through solar power. So that's kind of, I would say, an emerging application of this view where people are trying to link up the idea of energy and money, and particularly in the idea of trying to benefit the environment as well. I'm not sure if you're aware of SolarCoin or not. Is that something that you feel would represent the energy standard of money that you're thinking?
Well, yeah, I was not aware of it, but it certainly speaks, by the way you described it, to this fundamental idea that there is this deep linkage between what we call money and the energy that we use to do work. And that's a perfectly viable way to go. I would not look to create the linkage just based on one form of energy production, in this case solar. I think you need to have a standard of energy measure that is represented in money, and then that can come from solar or any of our energy sources, actually. But that sentiment is definitely what's at play there, is that people have recognized that there is this deep link between the idea of money and the energy that we have available to do useful work.
George, tell us a little bit about Howard T. Odum and how he fits into this.
Okay, well, Howard Odum was actually considered the father of systems ecology. He was an ecologist, and he studied food webs and the way in which energy flowed through an ecosystem. So obviously, you've got sunlight coming in, driving photosynthesis, what's called primary production. But you also have other sources of energy that may come in the direct form of wind power or water power or a number of other things. So water power, for example, being streams, and those streams, the way they flow, actually support communities that depend upon their being flowing water. So they, in one sense, extract some of their energy from that kind of environment. So he spent many years working on the ecology. He had a number of graduate students who worked with him, one of whom was Charlie Hall, who basically developed biophysical economics and has a book out on it, Energy and the Wealth of Nations, Understanding the Biophysical Economy. But Charlie Hall was one of his students who was an ecologist. And Odum had long recognized this deep relationship between energy and its flow through the work processes and the nature of wealth and the nature of value and how you could represent that in a monetary system. As far as I know, he was pretty much the origin of that whole way of thinking. He developed a modeling language that allowed people to build computer simulations of energy flows and the results of fluctuations in energy flows and what that did to an ecological system of some kind. So how did the species change as a result of changes in energy flows would be one way of looking at it. And he applied those same ideas to the economy and human society and asked questions such as, how would society change as a result of changes in the flow of energy? And one of the most obvious things that has happened is as we developed our coal and oil and natural gas resources over the years, over the period of the Industrial Revolution, and more recently after World War II, society has changed enormously and in ways that actually are very, very similar to what happens in a natural ecological system. For example, we know that there's a relationship between the species diversity, the number of species per unit of area, and the flow of energy into that area, the amount of photosynthesis that is being driven by sunlight, and the number of species of plants and animals that end up getting supported because of the availability of that energy. And if we look at our society and how it has evolved over the last, say, 100 years, of increasing our dependence on oil and gas and coal, look at the complexity that we've driven. I mean, today we have institutions and organizations, you name it. I mean, it's just a very, very complex society. The technology, if you think of all the different technologies that we got as sort of species of technology, you're looking at a tremendous variety. Though nobody has yet pinned this down in an experimental way, the theory of energy flow suggests that this is what we're looking at, that our society has been driven to high complexity by the fact that we've increased the flow of energy through it. And it has nothing to do with investment decisions or financialization or any of that kind of stuff. In fact, you could say all of that is in response to the increase in energy flow. But it's a theoretical framework that you really have to get into the causal relations that go on before you begin to get a real good sense of why it works the way it does. That's what Howard Odum started, the biophysical economics. And he was also one of the founding fathers of the ecological economics. So this guy was really, really quite prolific in terms of scientific ideas that got developed into real solid work. He was really quite a source of great ideas.
George, what are some of your own unique contributions to biophysical economics, ecological economics? Where do you fit into this?
I started with the biophysical economics group when it was fairly informal in Syracuse, New York at the SUNY Environmental Sciences and Forestry College, where Charlie Hall worked, I attended a conference meeting and gave a paper on the idea of energy and money. And this was before I knew that Charlie Hall had been Howard Odum's graduate student. I did not know that connection. In the paper, what I presented was, I thought Odum was absolutely correct in everything he did and that we should have paid closer attention to what his work was. But he did make one small conceptual error. It wasn't even really a conceptual error. It was a technical error in that he redefined the energy as something he called emergy, E-M-E-R-G-Y. And there's a perfectly good technical explanation of it. It represents embodied energy in the form of work that gets done and so on. So there wasn't anything technically wrong with it as such. But to link it to money, you actually needed to look at the energy before it went into the work process. And the technical measure for that is called exergy, E-X-E-R-G-Y. I don't want to go into all those technical details, but there's a slight difference between those two in terms of measure of value. And what I suggested was that we go back, revisit Odum's work, but substitute in this idea of exergy. Stated very simply, exergy is a direct measure of the amount of useful work that can be gotten out of that energy source. Engineers and thermodynamicists and so forth have a very clear understanding of what that means mathematically. So that caught some attention, and I proceeded to build a couple of models of what that would look like in an economic system. And I've continued to try to promote that. We take a look at that. So if the solar coin idea were to take off but be broadened, it would not actually look at the units of electricity directly, but the units of exergy that were represented by that electricity. The next thing, the biophysical economics group were looking very hard and continued to look at what's called the energy return on energy investment, or EROI, which put very simply means that as we're digging up this oil and coal and everything else, we always go for the easiest to get first. So easiest means we spend less energy obtaining the next unit of energy that we're going to supply to the economy. As we go along, those easy to get at resources become harder and harder, meaning that we have to do more physical work to get to them. So now we're in the stage in oil and gas, for example, where we're doing these fracking operations in order to get the oil and gas out of tight places, the shale rock formations and so forth. And that takes a lot of energy. So we have to spend more energy up front. So if you look at it from the investment standpoint, what it's saying is that we're getting less return on our investment as we go along because the investment potentials are poorer and poorer. Tar sands in Alberta are extremely expensive to produce in energy terms. So the energy return on the energy invested is going down, and there's no indication that we could ever recover or find some other way to do that. So what I did was I built another model. The worst case conditions that would apply if we somehow figured out how to get all or as much as we possibly could out of the resources in the ground while the energy return on energy investment was still continuing downward. And what I was able to show was that there's a point that we reach at which there's a relationship between debt financing, and I'm talking now about money, debt financing, which means you're going to be able to pay back in the future, pay back more than what you borrowed, because you're going to be doing more work in the future, producing more wealth. But the curves show that we actually will be producing less work and less wealth. And so there comes a point in time in that curve where it becomes literally impossible to pay back the loans, the borrowed money. So that was the second contribution that I made. Out of that, I was invited back every time. And finally, I'm on the board of directors for the International Biophysical Economic Society, which, by the way, is going to have a meeting in Washington, D.C., and I think it's in June. And people are starting to pay attention to that, too. That's some of the brighter politicians who know that they can't go on promising endless growth have actually begun to take a listen to that message, to the fact that there are physical limits and we are approaching them.
George, what do you think about a lot of the moves that we see now with alternative energy technologies? Peak oil was a major concern. There was a lot of ideas that we were going to see a collapse of society because we couldn't afford such high prices. And now we see a lot of movements in the direction of alternative technologies, whether or not that's harnessing ocean power or wind and solar, of course. Do you see these as positive moves? And do you think that they are significant enough to prevent perhaps some problems taking place in the future from our dependence on fossil fuels?
Well, this is a huge subject. It's not something I can encapsulate too easily in the short time available. But there are a couple of things we could look at. I tend to look at the outer boundaries of these problems and say things like, what's the worst case, what's the best case, and so on. And one of the things that it probably would behoove everybody to try to remember is that while solar energy is free and it's guaranteed to be there every day to one degree or another, depending on the clouds, you can walk around in it. The power value per unit area of solar energy is really quite low, which means that you have to have a very, very large collection aperture and a way of concentrating the power that comes in through that aperture. So it's like a magnifying glass. When we burned ants as children using magnifying glass, what you're doing is taking a large aperture area, collecting that sunlight, and then concentrating it so that you get enough power concentrated in one area to actually do anything. And people tend to forget this. They think of the sun as being this wonderful supply of energy, and certainly is for plants. There's no question about that. And it drives our wind as well, but it is just very low power. So we're comparing sunlight as a power source with fossil sunlight, which was a very large aperture, very large areas of the Earth over very extended periods of time, finally concentrated and compacted in the form of coal and oil and natural gas, the fossil fuels. That took millions and millions of years to do. You can take, say, a gallon of gasoline, for example, and move a car, and try to do this yourself by hand, move a car over a fairly long distance, a car that weighs a great deal. You're getting a lot of work done to get that done, but you would have to probably collect sunlight over roughly, let's say, the size of 2 football fields. That's very rough. For 20,000 years in order to get that same power. Now, here's where I think it's going to work. It's not a panacea. Solar energy, wind energy, and so forth, they're not going to be panaceas in the sense that as long as you demand maintaining the same kind of lifestyle that we've gotten used to in terms of transportation, in terms of high-power machines doing work on steel and concrete and all this kind of stuff, as long as you insist that that's what our society has to be, then solar is not going to do it. And I don't care how fast it ramps up, it simply doesn't have the power production capability to do that. It is very nice for low-scale kinds of applications, like put some solar collectors on your roof if you live in the right area, and you might even be able to get off the grid as long as you don't overdo your electrical consumption. And the people who, by the way, do that and do manage to get off the grid very frequently have gone to very low electric consumption lifestyles in order to achieve that. So that's sort of what's going to have to happen is society's going to have to recognize that they've been living on a dream for a long time with the high power that's available in fossil fuels. And if we're going to have a society based on solar energy and wind energy, even tidal energy, any of these alternative sources, we're going to have to get used to the idea that it's going to be using a lot less power than we're used to. That's my take on it.
So what you're saying is the level of complexity that we see in the economy today has largely been built off and sustained by very cheap source of energy, which is fossil fuels, and a lot of the alternative energy technologies that we see today that you just mentioned, solar, wind, or even ocean power, they are insufficient to fill that gap should our dependency on fossil fuels start to lessen, or if we do start to run into supply constraints. Would that be a fair summation of what you were saying?
That's correct, as long as we insist on this lifestyle.
Well, George, I want to thank you for coming on to our show and speaking with our audience. Do you have any last words or thoughts that you'd like to leave with them before you go?
I just got back from a conference in Austria. It was not really a conference. It was a meeting of top researchers in system science in the world. And the one thing that we've talked about for a number of years is if you look out into the world and look particularly at the problems that we face, global warming, diminishing fossil fuels, all of these kinds of things, they're systemically linked. And up until fairly recently, we have not done a very good job in our sciences and our economics of thinking in terms of systems and analyzing our situation in terms of system science. If we're going to begin to tackle these, and maybe it's not solar energy, maybe it's not wind energy, there might be some other form of energy that we haven't explored yet. But we wouldn't know it because we don't tend to think in those kinds of systems terms. So I would just like people to think about the fact that we're used to thinking about the world in a linear causal fashion. There's another way to look at it, and it is the only way that we're going to be able to solve the problems systemically, because they are systemic problems to begin with.
So once again, that was George Mobus. He is an associate professor at the University of Washington's Institute of Technology. He is the co-author of the 2014 textbook, Principles of Systems Science. He has a background in computer science, and his specialty is in now general systems science. And like we discussed today, it is possible to view the economy in terms of a biophysical system. And that is really looking at how energy is used for the use of work. I think what he said is the whole economy is based on work, and work is based on energy. And then money itself is really, like we discussed, it's a messaging system. It's a token that is used to convey information to both regulate the control and flow of matter and energy, and where it is used for work or for the production of goods and services. And so that's an application of thermodynamics. If you want to read any of George Mobus's work, I would recommend that you do so. You can Google his name, or I'll have some links to some of his presentations that he's done and some of the things that he's done in the past. Also, Howard T. Odom, which we mentioned, has some really fascinating work with regards to ecology and how ecology fits in to viewing the economy. So that will be something interesting as well to look at if you find this topic fascinating. I'm Chris Sheridan. You're listening to FS Insider at financialsense.com.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.